Hello all and welcome. I am so excited about this webinar. I think it is going to be a great, great experience. I think when you do webinars like this, it's tough when you have people with varying experience levels, but I think this is going to be special because everybody has this common ground of the experience of going through the 21-day program. With that out of the way, I've asked, when I was advertising this, I talked about how I wanted to review and summarize, to look at the program as a whole, and then also to answer people's questions. So we've gathered a bunch of questions from people. That'll be the second part. Before we do that, I want to do some review and summary. And that means having Alan talk a little bit about the big picture of the program, what it means and what his goals are, why it works, why the program works the way that it does. So Alan, would you be willing to talk a little bit about that? I do have some questions prepared, but I thought that I would just have you start off by doing your thing.
Sure. So the basis of the program is the first thing that I did was, are you able to hear me clearly?
Sure can.
Okay. I actually have a giant microphone that I could bring if that would make it clearer.
I think this sounds good.
Okay. So the first thing that I did was I wanted to lay out what pain was. I feel like we're on a hike with Lauren over there. So we talked a little bit about pain and what the purpose of pain is. So I think that that's a really important prerequisite to understand how to get rid of your pain is to understand what pain is. So essentially pain is a danger signal. This isn't TMS pain. This is just pain in general. The purpose of pain is to, it's a danger signal. It warns us. So for example, if you put your hand on a hot stove, the pain is letting you know you better move your hand or you might cause additional tissue damage. So pain is actually something that helps us. It warns us in the face of prospective threat or causing damage. But sometimes these danger signals can get activated even if there's no actual physical structural damage or even threat of damage. And one of my favorite examples of that is Lorimer Mosley is a pain scientist in Australia, and he was out on a hike with one of his friends, and he felt something against his left ankle. It just like a little prickling sensation, didn't even think much of it. He looked down and he was bit by one of the most poisonous snakes in the world, an eastern brown snake. They rushed him to the hospital. You know, he almost died and he was fine. 6 months later, he was hiking with his friends again and he felt something against that same ankle. And before he even looked down, his ankle just exploded with more pain than he had ever felt before. And he looked down and he was just scraped by a twig. It barely even caused a scratch. But what happened is his brain was actually interpreting that sensation as dangerous because of his past experience. And these danger signals had been activated. So what happens with TMS pain is our brain is activating these danger signals, essentially interpreting certain sensations as dangerous, even though they aren't. So the whole purpose of the program, basically, I mean, you could call it danger signal deactivation therapy if you want. Like, that's essentially what we're trying to do. We're trying to help people communicate to their brains this interpretation of danger is not actually an accurate reflection of what's going on in my body. It's simply my brain misinterpreting the cues. Assuming, of course, that you do have TMS. If you have an actual injury, then the pain is an accurate reflection. So the whole purpose of the program is to walk you through the different steps of essentially teaching your brain that the sensation that is interpreting is as dangerous is actually non-dangerous. That's it.
Okay. The thing which I was particularly drawn to was this idea of the paradox. I think you said the paradox of pain recovery in overcoming psychogenic pain. Do you remember talking about that?
Yeah. Yes, actually, I was. I wrote about that on day 20 also a little bit.
Tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. You know, I know that Christy, I know that you had an experience with this with your wrists also, but the first experience I ever had with this paradox was by accident. It was maybe like 2005 or 2006, and I had had head pain. Head pain was one of the worst TMS symptoms I had. It was every minute of every day for like 2 or 3 years, I had this persistent head pain. And one day I was just doing like mindfulness meditation. I just kind of learned about it, you know, some version of somatic tracking. And I'm checking in and I'm really just attending to my breath and I'm feeling the physical sensations in my body and it's feeling really good. And after about 10 minutes, I stop and I realize, oh my God, I don't have any head pain. Like the pain was gone. And I was so excited. I thought I found the answer, you know, like, all I need to do is check in with my body, kind of attend to my breath, really lean into it, enjoy it, and the pain will go away. So, of course, I immediately try it again, and my pain gets worse. And then the next day, the same thing. I'm checking in. I'm attending to the physical sensations in my body. I'm really breathing into it, and I'm constantly monitoring to see if my head pain is going away, and the pain gets worse. And for like a week, I'm like, I'm trying to repeat the same thing, but I'm not getting the same results. And the reason why is the first time I did it, I wasn't trying to get rid of the pain. I was just gravitating towards something positive. But then once I had an ulterior motive of trying to get rid of the pain, the motivation wasn't the same. I was trying to get rid of something. So when you're trying to get rid of something, when you're trying to push something away, when you're trying to escape something, Forrest, like what message are you communicating?
Fear and pressure.
Exactly. You're essentially communicating to yourself, this is dangerous. Why else would you need to escape? Why else would you need to get away? So by actually trying to get away from something, you're activating the very energy that is causing the pain in the first place. It's almost, cognitive exercise where if you try not to think of a pink elephant, immediately your mind is going to go to a pink elephant because you're trying not to. And it's very similar where if you're trying to get rid of the pain, you're generating pressure, you're generating fear, you're communicating to your brain, this is something I need to get away from. And even in communicating yourself, this is something I need to get away from, you're reinforcing the idea that it's dangerous. But on the other hand, if you're actually trying to gravitate towards something, if you're actually trying to go towards something positive, something good, you're communicating a message of safety. So that first time I did a mindfulness meditation exercise, I was leaning into the breath, I was feeling positive, it was filling me with a good feeling. And that's the only thing I was considering. And so the pain went away simply because I wasn't trying to get rid of the pain. I was trying to gravitate towards something good. I wanted to actually ask Christy about her experience with that. But before I did, Forrest, would it be okay if I read one of the posts from the days that someone recently posted?
Yeah, awesome. Go for it.
So under day 20, someone actually just made a post. And Forrest, I think I just sent you an email about it. This is literally everything. This is the most important component of TMS recovery. I think I say that like about four different things, by the way. So someone wrote a post this morning and it said, it was under the topic of embracing joy. And she was talking about embracing joy and also outcome independence. And she said, maybe today I practice my own looking for joy in combination with outcome independence. A beautiful sunny day here. I had one of my bad foot days. I thought, never mind my foot. I'm going for a walk. And I did in the sun, near the water, waved at passing boats, said hi to my neighbor with his dog. My foot did hurt a bit, but I told him or her, yes, foot, you hurt, but you know what? There are other parts of me that need attention today. My legs need to move and my spirit needs to enjoy the sun and outdoors. And I did enjoy it. Outcome independence at work. It was a walk I had joy about the rest of that day. And so you can see that's such a great example of like, you're not taking a walk to try to get rid of your foot pain. You're not challenging it with all this aggressive energy. You're simply enjoying your life and gravitating toward the positive instead of trying to eradicate the negative. And those are the things that we need to do to start generating a feeling of safety instead of a feeling of pressure and fear and aversion.
I love that example because I don't think that you can explain how to do that with words in terms of do this, do this, do this. You just have to inspire someone and say, hey, this is what someone did. This is something you can do also. Look for this in your life. Did I get that right?
Exactly. In fact, Christy had a really great example of this. So Christy and I did an outcome independence exercise because she had really bad wrist pain. She thought that it was structural for a long time. We gathered the evidence. We realized it was TMS. Her and I did an outcome independence exercise, which I think actually put up on day 5 of the program. And she actually overcame her wrist pain in the moment. It was the first time in 2 years that she was able to type without pain. And she was so excited. She was like, oh my God, this is all I need. The pain will be gone in a week. And Christy, tell them what happened in like the days or weeks after that incident.
Well, the pain was not gone in a week. It came back the next day, probably worse than it had been in the previous months. And it came back the day after that, and it came back the day after that. And I kept tricking myself. Each time the pain came back, my mind went back to structural. And I would call Alan, and I was like, that exercise was a fluke. I must have just been distracted. There's no way that this isn't structural. And he would make me listen to the recording over and over and over again to remind myself that I did have 2 minutes where I was typing without pain. And if you can have any of those exceptions where you're doing an activity that usually causes you pain and you experience a decrease in the pain, that is evidence that your body doesn't need it. But it probably took another 2 months before I was able to say that I kicked that symptom as well.
Because you kept trying to get rid of it, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was like, I did it once. I can do it again. If I did it once, I have to be able to recreate it, and I would get disappointed every time the pain came on. So I was doing the complete opposite of outcome independence.
Yeah.
And it does not sound like an easy process either. Like you, I don't want to say you had to fight it, or should I say you had to fight it? Were you fighting it?
I think that she had to fight her desire to fight it.
That's interesting. Tell me about that.
Me?
Christy, tell her about it.
Oh, I meant you, but Christy, take it.
I had to fight my desire to fight it. Yeah. I just saw this pop up in the chat box, and I think it's a good point. Rick was saying, I don't think I can fool myself into thinking I don't want the pain or anxiety to go away. And I don't think we need, all of us want our pain or anxiety to go away. That's the end goal for all of us. And I feel like I have to remind my patients of that sometimes when they're working on outcome independence is, I haven't forgot your long-term goal. I know that you hope to have decreases in pain as well, but you need to be really honest with yourself and understand that your pain will never go away if you are pressuring yourself to get the pain to go away. So it's not that you have to tell yourself, you don't need to fool yourself into thinking that you don't want the pain to go away, but you need to be honest with yourself that as long as you are pressuring yourself and fighting yourself, it is not going to go away.
Yeah, Christy, I mean, we were talking about Christy fighting the urge to fight the pain, but you're not really fighting. That's the point. It's like if you don't engage in your desire to fight the pain, you know, as soon as you're fighting, they say that, you know, what you resist will persist. If you engage in that kind of fighting energy, you're just generating tension and you're continuing to communicate messages of danger to your brain. Is Rick with us, or is he only over text?
Probably is. I will unmute you, Rick. You don't have to talk, but now you can if you want.
Talk, Rick.
Rick ain't talking. Rick, you can start talking if you want. Or write in the chat room if you prefer. I wanted to...
Technical difficulty, Rick said.
Oh, I see. Technical difficulty. Okay, good. This feels a lot like meditation, where if people want to meditate, you can't meditate. And so, I mean, I've read a bunch of books on mindfulness. Do you see that connection there? Is it similar?
I mean, it isn't necessarily if you want to meditate, you can't meditate.
Yeah, that's the wrong way to say it. Yeah,
because if you don't want to meditate, you're never going to meditate. That would be a paradox. I think what it is, so a lot of times when people want to meditate, every time a thought pops into their mind, you know, if they look at themselves as like trying to keep the thoughts from popping into their mind, the thoughts are just going to continue popping into their mind. So it's like the goal isn't to keep the thoughts from popping into your mind. The goal is to bring your attention back to your breath when they do. So, you know, it's really the idea of trying to keep the thoughts from popping into your mind is inherently counterproductive. But, you know, I think Rick made a really good point. I'm going to talk for him until he figures it out, his technical difficulties. So Rick is saying, I don't think I can fool myself into not wanting the pain and anxiety to go away. It's impossible not to want the pain and anxiety to go away. There are two different things that you can do. You know, one of the things I think I wrote about it in day 20 also was any organism that is in a state of suffering is going to try to get out of suffering. You know, if you're walking along and you see a bug on the ground and it's like upside down and it's like flailing its little legs trying to right itself, that's an organism that's in a state of suffering that is desperately and urgently trying to get out of a state of suffering. If you see a plant that isn't getting enough sunlight and it kind of starts leaning in toward the light, right, that's an organism that's in a state of suffering that's trying to get out of a state of suffering. So Rick just realized that his computer doesn't have a microphone. So, you know, when we're in a pain state, we're going to want to try to get out of a pain state the same way that a bug is going to want to try to get back to on its feet, the same way that a plant is going to want to try to get sunlight. We're going to want to try to escape a state of suffering because that's what organisms in a state of suffering do. So we're not saying that you have to not try to get out of pain, because you can't not try to get out of pain. It's literally impossible. Just know that the times when you do that are not helping you get out of pain. It's when you're doing the other things. It's when you're taking a hike and enjoying the sun and really kind of like gravitating toward the positive. That's when you're actually doing this stuff to help you overcome your symptoms. The times when you're actually engaging in these behaviors to try to get rid of the pain is just an organism acting out of their evolutionary instinct when they're in a state of suffering. You can't not do it. It just isn't helpful. So know that when you're trying to get rid of your pain, oh, this is just kind of my animalistic brain trying to escape a state of suffering. That's what it's going to do. And it'll pass. And then during those other opportunities, when you have the ability to gravitate toward joy or love or gratitude or empowerment, those are the times when you're actually making progress. So hopefully that answers your hypothetical question, Rick.
Well, maybe ITMSW can follow up on that, because it sounds like she feels the same way. We can take that next.
Hello?
Hello, hello.
Oh, okay. You can hear me. Oh, yes, I do feel the same way as Rick. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I was just writing in the chat that on Thursday, I really tried to lean into the pain. And so that was kind of an all-day event. And then I also tried to just kind of focus on joyous things. But then I got confused because I didn't know if that's ignoring my pain, to just go about my day and pretend like I'm not in pain, in that pain. So by evening, it was just really, really bad and had to take some medication for that. So I don't know if you could clarify on that. Because I know with TMS, you're saying that it's also about anger that you're not addressing. So then that's why I was wondering, if I ignore it and focus on the positive, am I just pushing it down, you know, further downward, I guess. Is that clear? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know what ignore the pain means. How could anyone ignore pain?
Yeah. I guess not address it in not leaning into the pain not trying to figure out if there's, you know, something bothering me.
You said something really interesting. You said, I was trying to enjoy the day.
Right.
Were you enjoying the day?
I think there were, you know, times where I was able to put it out of my mind and enjoy, you know, some specific moments. But then I was like, oh, I don't know if I'm supposed to be doing that or if I'm just supposed to be leaning into the pain. I got all confused. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like what happened is you had glimpses of joy, and then your brain was like, this isn't familiar. We need to go back to a place of confusion and fear and pressure.
Okay.
What could we do to kind of bring her back to this familiar state? I know. We could give her the thought, oh, am I doing this right? Maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe I should be focusing on anger. Am I using the right intervention? Am I doing it correctly? Like, literally, even the question you're asking is just your mind's way to try to bring you back to that familiar state of fear and pressure and limbo. You were enjoying the day, and then your brain snatched defeat out of the jaws of victory by telling you you were doing it wrong, by asking you, maybe I'm doing the wrong thing. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's clear. Thank you so much.
Christy, did you want to follow up on that, or shall I move to the next question?
Yeah, I was just going to say, Irene, I think you did a lot of great things. And I think sometimes now that people have many tools, they are starting to preoccupy not only about their pain, but now they're preoccupying about which tool they should use for their pain.
Right, exactly.
Kind of up there for a few minutes. But overall, I think you did a great job, and that's fine that your pain went up. You were using a bunch of different strategies. Your fear was down for much of the day, so you don't have anything to worry about. You're doing a great job.
Thank you so much, you guys. Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, one of the things I liked about that when you wrote it out. So when you said that, I wrote the words down, and now I can't seem to find it. But you talked about the preoccupation cycle. And how it sucked us in. I really enjoyed that. When you were talking just now, you also were doing ideas. What I heard was being present. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
And I guess I'm also asking because I believe you had mentioned a book called Fully Present, and I was just wondering if you could tie that into the language of being fully present. And also, could you tie what you're saying in, will it work to tie what you're saying into the idea of allowing things to happen as opposed to forcing things to happen? Does that make sense? Is there anything in there that you can run with?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And Irene, that's what I meant by, like, what do you mean you were trying to enjoy the day? You know, like, sometimes when you're, like, trying to do something as a way to get rid of your pain or something like that, it's hard for it to kind of experience it organically. Because you're actually, you know, sometimes you could attempt to feel joy as a means to an end. But it's when you you know, sometimes it's hard to force yourself to feel joy. So sometimes what I'll do is I'll, you know, kind of check in and attend to my internal state, and lots of things are going to come along. Sometimes you're going to feel anxiety. Sometimes you're going to feel sadness. Sometimes you're going to feel joy. And so, you know, I was just like checking in, and you're kind of waiting for joy to come along. And then when it does, you're like, there you are, and really lean into it and let yourself feel it, knowing that it's going to pass. So you're not necessarily like trying to force it. Just like Forrest said, you're just opening yourself up for that when it comes along, you could experience it. But Irene, I think that for you, it's really a matter of just kind of like honing your inner Christy. You could hear that, you know, Christy was like pointing out the things that you did well in celebrating the fact that you did those things well. And I could actually hear while she was saying that, like, how much it struck you, how much it meant to you, like how good it felt. So I think that catching yourself doing something positive and celebrating yourself for it is one of those things that could change those neural pathways in your brain, right? So you're out there and you're feeling joy and you got a glimpse of joy and you were like, that's great, I did it. And I was feeling joy and I'm proud of you for it.
Okay.
Hone your inner Christy.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
So Alan, do you want to be picking up questions from the chat room and just running with those? My inclination is to say, you know, I had three structured things that I wanted to go over that I thought were really interesting, and then I was going to take the most liked posts from the questions thread. Do you have any feedback on how you want to do that? Does that sound like a good thing?
Sounds great.
So I'm going to leave it up to you and Christy. Whenever you see a question in the chat room that you think is relevant to what we're talking about, then we'll do that. Otherwise, we'll stick with the program.
Great.
Okay. And I'll let you guys make that call. Maybe I'll call one out if I see one particularly relevant. Okay. The next thing is that I was really curious about is why does somatic tracking work? And we've all done the 21 days. Maybe we can handle a big theoretical question like this. You said something that somatic tracking breaks the vessel of reinforcement. And I thought that was beautiful language. And then you said, because it's curiosity, not danger, the idea that you were taking your what's going on in your body and approaching it with curiosity, not danger. And I was wondering, could you run with that stuff and tell us a little bit about why somatic tracking works and perhaps tell us about your experience. I think you mentioned that at a certain point you decided to start somatic tracking each day. I thought that was incredibly powerful, the way that you told that to us. Mm-hmm. And it also tells us a little bit about what one needs to do to make it work, maybe, or does not one not have to do that. But could you kind of riff on that?
I feel like your questions have questions.
Yeah, it's like 17 layers. You just get to choose the part you like.
Right. It's many options. So what actually happens is, you know, in our brain, there are five different frequencies of brain waves. And two of the brain waves are particularly of interest to us. Beta waves are the waves that we really engage in when we're alert. You know, oftentimes when we're in a state of fight or flight, we're engaging in beta waves. When we are in a more meditative state, when we're in a calmer state, when we're not in a state of alertness, then there's a stronger emphasis on alpha waves. And they've actually found that somatic tracking, attending to the bodily, the sensations in your body, you actually develop the skill to control the rhythm of your alpha waves. So it's literally like a way of being able to control the volume on your sensory knobs in your brain. So they found that through somatic tracking, and you know, it's the neuroscience around it is relatively new. They're still doing a lot of studies on this out of Brown University. But generally speaking, they found that attending to the physical sensations in your body changes your relationship with certain brain waves, so that you're going from a beta state to an alpha state. essentially communicating the message to your brain, this thing is safe, not dangerous. So, you know, what happens is when you attend to a physical sensation with a from a place of fear, you're giving yourself the message, this is dangerous. When you're attending to a physical sensation from a place of judgment, you're giving yourself the message, this is not okay. You know, when you're attending to a physical sensation in your body, trying to get rid of it, you're giving yourself the message, this is not safe. But when you learn to attend to the physical sensations in your body free of fear, free of judgment, free of ulterior motive, you're ultimately giving your brain the message, this is safe. And that's how you turn off the danger signals.
Cool.
Yeah.
Travin in the chat room says, I would appreciate some help on how to feel my bodily sensations. I often feel that I can't feel anything. Since we're talking, it does feel on topic since we're talking about somatic tracking.
Christy, why don't you take this?
Sorry, I was muted. If when you check in with yourself, you're not yet aware of any bodily sensations, that's okay. I think that's just a sign that you need to keep practicing. So just block off maybe 10 minutes at the beginning of your day, 10 minutes at the end of the day, where you're lying down, breathing, and just watching if anything comes up in your body. I don't think it's really possible for a human to not be able to have anything pop up in terms of bodily sensations. I think we're just not used to paying attention to it. So Travin, I would say that's totally fine that you can't feel it yet. I think it's just a sign that you need a little bit more practice.
Travin, I actually have a friend who had a very similar scenario where he went on a 10-day mindfulness meditation retreat. And, you know, one of the Buddhist monks was, leading this exercise and attending to your physical sensations. And he said, I was doing it for like 2 straight hours and I felt nothing. So when he came back into town, we actually, we started doing this practice where he would just practice sitting and actually attending to the physical sensation of his feet on the ground. Right. So what does it feel like when your feet are on the ground? Where do you feel it in your feet? And he would do that for 10 minutes. And then at 10 minutes at the end of the day, he would be lying down and he would be paying attention to the physical sensation of his back on the bed. Right. Because, I mean, unless you were born without, you know, sensory nerves, you're going to feel physical sensations. So even lying on the bed and attending to the physical sensations of your back against the bed, you're going to feel the sensation of your back against the bed. So if you practice attending to different physical sensations that are there, you could teach your brain the art of attending to physical sensations, and it will make it easier.
Excellent. Okay. So again, I do see some questions scrolling by, and we're going to focus on the pre-organized schedule. We'll take the broader questions at the end. If you are able to go to that thread that I sent you and put your question in on the forum, I'll put that in the chat room right now so people can do that. And oops, sorry, I sent that wrong.
Hey, Could you read Barry's question to Christy, or Chris, as he's given her the nickname?
Christy, it is very hard to transition from fear to awareness. I find that somatic tracking often evolves into obsessiveness.
Yeah. I noticed this when Alan first posted about it. I think people push back on somatic tracking in the beginning because it feels like we are asking you to focus or obsess on the pain. And I think a lot of us have read and heard that preoccupying over the pain is bad. Preoccupying is a form of fear. The more that I fear it, the worse it's going to get. So the first time we introduced somatic tracking, I think it kind of freaked a lot of people out because it felt like we were asking you to obsess over something. But I have found that people who are afraid to focus on the sensation are actually putting a ton of pressure on themselves throughout the day to ignore the sensation, which, like Alan mentioned earlier, is not possible. If you feel something in your body, you're going to feel it. So somatic tracking is actually helping you grapple with the fact that you are feeling something. It is okay to notice it. And this is a tool that will help you notice it without fear. And noticing something without fear should feel really good. It should feel like you're attending to yourself. It should feel like you might be calming yourself down. And I think that is the exact opposite of preoccupation. I think that's the exact opposite of obsessing, because I think obsessing and preoccupying involves fear. Somatic tracking just involves attending to yourself in a way that should feel good.
I think that Barry, you probably have a difficult time attending to things free of fear. You know, oftentimes when I will point out to someone that they beat themselves up, you know, oh, you really seem to come at yourself really hard. You criticize yourself. You really beat yourself up. They'll respond with, oh, you're right. I do. What the hell is wrong with me? You know, when I will start talking to someone and point out the fact that they're putting pressure on themselves, they'll respond to that by saying, oh, you're right. Like, I have to stop doing that. You know, they're putting pressure on themselves not to put pressure on themselves. So I think that Barry, you know, one of the issues is that it's very hard for you to attend to something free of that intensity and that alertness and that fear. I think that, you know, your brain will turn a tool into a weapon because it's hard for you to pay attention to anything free of fear. So just like you can, you know, point out to someone, just like you can put pressure on yourself not to put pressure on yourself, just like you could beat yourself up for beating yourself up, I feel like what you're doing is you're paying attention to something the only way you know how, with intensity and alertness and fear. So I think a goal for you would be to practice in glimpses trying to pay attention free of that fear, from a place of, like Christy was saying, curiosity and actual interest, even if it's just for a few seconds at a time at first. Then over time, you'll actually be able to use these tools without your mind corrupting them and turning them into weapons. Rob, did that make sense? Or were you reading?
Can I answer?
Yes.
I think you're 100% right, and I don't remember her name. I think it's Dr. Zaz. She writes about hypervigilance and the same concept of that we beat ourselves up and we're constantly looking. The problem that I find, and I've raised the question before and a number of other people have had it, it's really hard to transition from that monitoring, constant monitoring of the pain, to being able to simply observe the pain when you're in the pain. And I've had a lot of TMS pains. Most of them have eased up except for my neuropathy, and it bothers me when I walk. Well, it's really hard when you're walking and trying to just observe the pain, and the other part of my brain is going, no, I want to get rid of the pain. And how do you make that, how do you take that break?
You know, I often look at being able to pay attention to the pain without fear is like, you know, punch like a karate student punching through a brick. You know, you're not really able to do that until you're like a black belt. You know, I think that earlier on, as you, Christy, you looked, you had such like interest in like, how is he going to finish that analogy? oftentimes I like to start by having people pay attention to the physical sensations in their body, like the anxiety that they feel, or, you know, emotions that they feel, or different twinges here or there. But when it comes to the paying attention to the pain free of fear, that's kind of like a higher level skill. I mean, literally, if you're able to pay attention to the pain without any fear at all, the pain's going to go away. So that's kind of like the last step before even getting rid of the pain. I'm actually in the process of editing the program this weekend, and it's going to go up in its final form on Monday. But there's one exercise that we're going to do called systematic desensitization or gradual exposure, where it's going to teach you incrementally to try to attend to the pain free of fear. But for the time being, I would just practice using somatic tracking on the other sensations in your body. And if your mind takes you to the pain, you could just be like, oh, no, it's not time for that yet, instead of trying to force yourself to attend to the pain free of fear. Good question, though. Thanks for asking that. Okay, Forrest, what else we got? You're on mute, Forrest.
Christy and I were thinking, and potentially Christy can take this, that since we're talking about topics of internal state while you're doing other things, perhaps this would be a good time to segue to Rick's question, which just had a huge number of likes when I posted it. So the question is this. Rick, do you want to unmute yourself and read it? Or shall I?
He's the one who had issues.
Okay, great. My Rick's question is this. Two things I have read or heard according to the theories of TMS. One is that the more a neural pathway is activated, the more ingrained the neural pathways become. And two is that to overcome a fear, one must engage in the activity one fears in order to see that it's not dangerous. So what if every time one engages in the activity, one's fears are realized? Then it becomes more and more ingrained and the whole situation gets worse. So two examples. When I walk too far, my back and legs hurt. If I do it anyway, trying to have a new attitude about the pain, it hurts more. The more I do that, the more ingrained it becomes, right? Two.
No.
All right. Traveling to new places creates anxiety. I want to overcome that. So if I travel anyway and I become more anxious from doing so, it becomes more ingrained. So I get stuck with the choices of avoiding the activities, which limits my life, or engaging them and making the neural pathways stronger. What do I do?
I love this question, and I actually want to use Christy as an example. So Christy had a fear of flying for a really long time. She was on a plane that...
Oh, let Christy say it, though. Do you want to say it, Christy?
I actually don't know where he's going with this.
Oh, okay. All right, then, fair enough.
We'll let him finish and circle back.
Okay.
I want to talk about Rick's...
Christy, you were on a plane. Did it catch on fire, or did I make that up?
No, it didn't catch on fire, but I was on a plane where even the flight attendants were like, this is it.
Yeah.
Hold hands with your neighbor and
yeah, this is it.
It was really scary.
it's not a good sign when even the flight attendants are freaked out. So ever since then, that incident, Christy had a fear of flying, and you know, she hated flying. She didn't, you know, her parents are back east, and she had to go back, and you know, she didn't do it. And so, you know, we talked about, you know, the only way to overcome a fear is to lean into the fear. And so she had a really great experience, and you know, it was going well, and she was able to kind of talk herself down. And then she was texting me. She was in Connecticut, and she was going to fly back to Los Angeles. And the pilot or the administrators came over the intercom, and they said, in the airport, if you need to go to the bathroom now, because there's so much turbulence, you're not even going to be able to like get up the entire flight. And she was just terrified, right? So if you go back up into a plane and you experience another terrifying situation, you're just re-traumatizing yourself. It's not just about engaging in the activity that generates fear. It's about engaging in the activity that generates fear in a way where you can have a corrective experience. Otherwise, you're just reinforcing the fear. So if you have a fear of flying, right, and you get back up in the plane and you're giving yourself authentic messages of safety all the time, then you're engaging the activity that you associate with fear, but having a corrective experience because you're giving yourself a message of safety. If you go up in a plane and you're giving yourself really authentic messages of empowerment, you can do this, bring the anxiety on, you know, it's going to be okay, you can handle this, you're giving yourself a corrective experience, and you're re-engaging in that that pattern while teaching your brain this is safe. So it's not just about throwing yourself back into the fear. It's about throwing yourself back into the fear while perpetuating messages that it's going to be okay. That was a great question, though. Do you remember that, Christy?
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, it is a great question. And going back to your first example, because that one relates more to pain. If you go for a walk and your back and legs hurt and it causes pain, that's fine. That in and of itself is not a problem. If you're able to go for a walk and you have pain, or you don't have pain and you're able to kind of, as Alan says, have a corrective experience, or I call it complete the loop. You're able to go for the walk. You may or may not have pain, and you tell yourself, I survived this. I walked. I'm fine. This was safe. I may be feeling pain, but I know that the pain that I'm feeling is not caused by the act of walking. It is caused by my fear around the act of walking. I did it. I'm fine. You completed the loop. It doesn't matter that it hurt more because you had a corrective experience.
What is this new lingo you're coming up with that I don't know about?
I haven't run it by you yet.
You're writing your own program, are you?
I just think it's a little bit friendlier than corrective experience.
No, I love that. And Rick actually just asked the question that you just answered, I think, while you were answering it. Giving yourself a corrective experience isn't easy. And I think what Christy's saying is, you know, talking about outcome independence. Look at us having a little lingo war right now, or completing the loop, if you will, is a way of giving yourself a corrective experience independent of whether or not you have pain. So Rick, your question of what if your positive messages don't work? Work to what? Work to get rid of the pain, or work to allow you to enjoy the moment independent of the pain? We need to identify what work even means. Enjoy the moment independent of the pain, Rick says. I mean, again, you can't force yourself to enjoy the moment, but even if you just practice opening yourself up to enjoying the moment, that's successful. You know, you don't want to come back after you take a walk and, you know, if you're not in a good mood, you look at it as a failure. Even just in opening yourself up to enjoying the mood, you know, the walk and being in an open space, that's successful. We don't want this to become a thing where it's like, now you're not outcome independent with pain, but now you're outcome independent with joy. We don't want to set it up as this kind of like binary dichotomy where either you're successful or you're unsuccessful. Either it works or it doesn't work. You're just opening yourself up to experiencing the moment, and that's something you can't fail at.
There was actually one of the quotes about that first thing I wanted to bring up. One of the things that you said is that the way to get rid of the pain is to not care if you get rid of the pain. I thought that was a powerful quote, and I guess it ties into outcome independence. Thanks for your question, Rick.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Well, if you do have more follow-up questions, it feels like we've gone in deep on that question, and maybe we can make that one of the main themes of this webinar. So, Lauren says, wow, you're helping me so much on my walk.
We know you're on your walk, Lauren. we're on the hike with you. Thanks.
Lauren's iPhone is showing her webcam is moving a lot. Anyway, okay, so So that sounds good. The next thing, which I loved that you wanted to talk about, that you've talked about, is perhaps worth reviewing, and then maybe we can get into Siobhan's question, is the idea of fear thoughts. I don't know if this will help set up that question, but we'll try. You were talking about why we have fear thoughts and where fear thoughts come from, talking about what your brain does to create fear thoughts and why it does it.
Christy.
Yes.
Christy loves the show Friends. It's a Alan, great show.
More than I love anything, Alan loves to use me as example.
Christy loves the show Friends. So Christy, you know, obviously like Friends was on while you were growing up. You were just like excited to watch it every Thursday. What happens if you're at home and a rerun comes up and you watch it? Like, what feeling does it give you?
Oh, joy. Pure joy.
But why? Even if you've seen the same episode 10 times.
It's comforting.
It's comforting. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm always sending Christy like, hey, I want you to watch this. I want you to watch that. And she never watches anything I send her. Like, I still feel like she hasn't seen the movie Good Will Hunting just because I told her to watch it 3 years ago. But whenever I send Christy anything like, oh, you know, Matthew LeBlanc was on The Tonight Show and told like a new story about Friends, she will watch it within 4 seconds. The reason why is because we gravitate toward what is familiar with us, to us. You know, it's like that feeling that you have of going to your favorite restaurant or your favorite bar. You know, it's like it gives you that feeling of familiarity. What is familiar to us is comfortable. So if you grew up in an environment where you didn't feel entirely safe, that state of fear or being in a fight or flight state becomes so familiar that our mind constantly gravitates back toward it over and over. So that as strange as it sounds, existing in a state of joy or a state of peace could actually cause anxiety just because it's so unfamiliar. And this goes back to Irene's question, right? So she went out, she was like opening herself up to enjoying the day. And she said, I started feeling a few glimpses of joy. And what happens? Her mind automatically takes her back to that familiar place of fear. Oh, but am I supposed to be enjoying my day? Am I supposed to be ignoring the pain? What about the whole anger thing? Should I be doing this instead? So when you're able to kind of see behind the curtain and actually see that these fear thoughts that you have aren't real dangers, but it's just a way for your mind to bring you back to a familiar state, it's a lot easier not to buy into those fear thoughts. Oh, there's another fear thought. That's my mind just trying to bring me back toward this familiar state. It's okay. It's all right. You're safe. We could create a new default setting instead of this old one with fear as a backdrop.
And you also talked about the idea of a fear boost. Do you want to tell us about that?
A fear boost or a safety boost?
Safety boost. Fear boost is a bad idea. We got that handled.
Yeah. That's for a different webinar. People who are too emotionally healthy. So the safety boost, yeah, it's something that it's essentially a way I look at fear thoughts and pain, TMS pain at least, is nothing more than a barometer for how safe your primitive brain feels, right? So if you have pain, if you're having fear thoughts coming in, that's essentially like, oh, that's just a message that this part of your brain does not feel safe. So instead of even necessarily engaging with the fear thought or engaging with the pain, you can kind of look at it as a sign that, okay, this primitive part of my brain isn't feeling safe right now. And you could go straight to the source. So one great way to essentially communicate a message of safety to the primitive part of your brain is to communicate a message of safety through three channels simultaneously. So one of the channels is they found that if you put your hand on your chest, that the same part of the brain lights up that lights up when someone gives you a hug, right? So it's really like figuratively almost like giving your own primitive brain a hug. So if you put your hand on your chest, that's one way of communicating a message of safety to your primitive brain. If you slow your breath down a little bit and just focus on the physical sensation of the breath coming in and out, that activates those alpha waves that I was talking about, attending to your internal state, focusing on the physical sensation of the breath. So that's another way of communicating a message of safety to your primitive brain. And then finally, if you actually say either out loud or to yourself, you're safe, you're cognitively communicating a message of safety through your brain. So you're going through three different channels simultaneously to communicate a message of safety to this primitive part of your brain. You're doing it cognitively, you're doing it somatically, and you're essentially letting this part of your brain know you're safe through multiple channels simultaneously. And that's something that you can do throughout the day. That's something that you can do when you have a fear thought. That's something that you can do when you have a fear thought associated with the pain. You're safe, right? So it's a safety boost. You're kind of bombarding yourself with messages of safety through multiple channels simultaneously.
Cool. Okay, well, those were the three things that I wanted to cover. Now let's do some of the user-submitted questions. Do you want to do Rick's follow-up, or should I do the first user-submitted question? Lauren's out on her walk.
Oh, I'm trying to figure out how to do all this stuff, techie, as I'm walking. I love you guys. You're amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Lauren, are you walking upside down? What's happening right now?
I think it's just the phone is upside down. I don't know if she's upside down.
That actually makes more sense.
All right. So I haven't had a chance to read Rick's questions. So what I'm going to do is let's answer this first user-submitted question from the website. Question one, I'm working on outcome independence, wondering if Alan and or Christy could offer further insights on how to sustain this stance. So easy to get sidetracked into fear.
Yeah, it is. I think people just want to be masters of outcome independence right away. It's the hardest shift to make in TMS recovery, in my opinion. So that's fine. If you get sidetracked into fear one day, then you have a question to ask yourself when you wake up the next day. Are you going to get back on the horse, or because you mess up one time, are you done? So that's fine. If you get sidetracked into fear, just notice it and redirect. Come back to, no, if my symptoms go up, that doesn't mean I'm failing. If my symptoms go down, that doesn't mean I'm doing well. I am doing well as long as I'm taking care of myself and not responding with fear. It's just a matter. I think that one just comes back down to practice and having an inner Christy.
You can't say that. I say that. when you're trying to make inner Christy happen, aren't you? They've actually found that most diets fail for the same reason. Someone is on a diet and it's going really well, and then on day 13, they like fall off the wagon and they eat a donut. And they feel really bad about themselves and they're like, ugh, it's over. So then day 14 comes and they like eat terribly because they had a donut on day 13. And they actually found that for a diet to be successful, if you have the ability to fall off the wagon and say, that's okay, it was just a setback, but tomorrow is a new day, just like what Christy was saying, that's what allows diets and you know, new regimes to be successful. Like creating a new paradigm where a mistake doesn't mean you've fallen off the wagon. It's a temporary setback and the next day is a new day. So you get sidetracked into fear and you're like, well, that's okay, because there's another opportunity in 3 hours. You know, when you don't want to necessarily look at them as failures, but just part of the process of changing your neural pathways. You know, even when Christy was trying to overcome her wrist pain for those 2 or 3 months, you know, she would have so many instances where she would get like sucked back into the frustration and trying to get rid of it and, you know, angry that it was still there. But then the next day was like another opportunity. So over 2 or 3 months, she was able to kind of shift her relationship with that. But it's part of the growth process.
Rick had a follow-up question, which may be related to this. He writes, I guess baby steps are important because doing something very fearful and making the negative neural pathway stronger is a pretty bad bummer. It's a slippery slope. I guess what I mean by it didn't work in the original question is that if I tell myself corrective thoughts and I still have a great pain or anxiety, the negative pathway will get worse, right? In other words, if I fly and the same old pain and anxiety comes up, it'll prove my feelings that travel will cause anxiety and pain. Thus, the neural pathways will be more ingrained. And I guess perhaps if I can add my own, what he's asking there is, if I fly and I get anxious, did that mean that I was pushing myself too far? How big of the baby steps can I get away with taking?
I don't look at pain and anxiety as a sign of failure. I look at pain and anxiety as an opportunity for practice. Baby steps are great. You know, in the gradual exposure day, we actually talk about how to take baby steps. You know, the way that we learn everything is through baby steps. You know, sometimes when some of my grad students are like, ugh, it's just like this 15-page paper is just like too much and they keep pushing it back. You know, I'll tell them like, just do the intro paragraph by tomorrow, you know, and then they've done that. And then it's like, okay, by the end of the next day, just finish the end of the first page. That's your only goal. And so baby steps could actually make things seem a lot more attainable. But to answer your question, no, if the anxiety comes up, that's an opportunity for practice. You're not able to practice changing your relationship with fear, except in instances where you feel fear. So if you're able to actually reframe pain or anxiety as, ugh, this is a sign of failure, or ugh, this is something I need to get rid of, and replace it with, oh, this is this beautiful opportunity where I could actually practice changing my relationship with fear by giving myself these messages while I'm in this state, it could really kind of change pain and anxiety to something you want to get rid of, as opposed to an opportunity for practice.
Sounds good. The next, Rick writes, I guess I'm too afraid of the pain and anxiety to even try, at least for something like flying. I guess I'm Rick's voice today.
Apparently.
Yeah. Did you want to respond to that?
Christy, go for it.
I guess I'm too afraid of the pain and anxiety to even try. Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that's okay for right now. Maybe that is too big of a step. I want you to think of, it sounds like you and a lot of people with TMS, we have a phobia response when our pain comes on. It comes on and we have the same experience that we would have if we had a phobia of spiders and spiders rushed into the room. So if I had a phobia of spiders, I wouldn't have 10 tarantulas come into my bedroom on day one. I would probably want to like get familiar with the daddy long legs first. Like what? Think about a tarantula. So I think, Rick, that's okay. If flying is like a 10 out of 10 phobia for you and that doesn't feel like a baby step, that's perfectly fine.
Just hone your own daddy long legs, your inner daddy long legs. That's all you need to do.
You're the worst.
Okay. Next one is, thanks, daddy long legs. Next question is, it's hard to distinguish between somatic tracking and obsessing when you are in pain. Are there any tips to distinguish on this?
Somatic tracking, by definition, is the opposite of obsessing. Obsessing truly means paying attention to your symptoms from a place of fear and alertness. You know, what somatic tracking is, the very foundation of somatic tracking, is paying attention free of fear. So, you know, the purpose of somatic tracking is to, yeah, and so we're getting multiple questions like this, and that's, it seems like it's hard for a lot of you to pay attention free of fear to anything.
That's interesting. I mean, I think that that could be the one of the goals of a webinar like this, is to identify what people working on this at home are going to have difficulty with, because I mean, this is a, it's a different environment doing it on your own. So, but, and repetition has proven to work. If I can slip in after what Christy was saying before about titrating, how, you know, daddy long legs in it. I think that's something which, in the community, it's got wings. In the community, in the online community, I think that we find that there's always a feeling that never go faster than you're ready for. You know, the only person who can tell you how much is enough is you. And, if you, work on the mind game first, get yourself comfortable, and then just do it because you're ready to. That's kind of the old advice.
I actually love that idea, that question of somatic tracking. You know, it's hard to somatic track free of obsessiveness. I think that's indicative of, but for some people, they're in such a state of alertness that it's difficult to focus on any internal sensations free of fear. And so in those situations, you could actually apply what Christy and Rob are talking about specific to somatic tracking. So you could actually start by just paying attention to the physical sensations in your feet and see if you can do it just for 5 or 10 seconds, free of fear, free of that intensity, and just kind of watch it. And if that's too hard, then start with a book on the other side of the room. I'm seeing books behind you. I just had a Kaiser Soze moment. right? So you can just look at the wall opposite you and see if you can actually just pay attention to the wall for 5 or 10 seconds. Free of fear, free of intensity, just to practice paying attention to something, anything, from a place of objective curiosity. And the more you're able to do that, the more you could start centering the object of that focus on things that are more scary, like your internal state. Did that make sense for us?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think in many cases, a lot of the answer here is, like, when people come on the forum and they're frustrated and they're overwhelmed, and for whatever reason, I see them jumping around topic to topic, or then you kind of get a sense that they need help. And so in many of these situations, when you're overwhelmed by these emotions and having difficulty controlling them, then the first thing, the best thing which you want to do is go see a practitioner. A practitioner can really, really help in that sense. They can, I mentioned this in the chat room, they can get you over the hump. In the absence of that, when that isn't an option for whatever reason, I'm wondering, I really am seeing a lot of parallels here between what you've been talking about in it and mindfulness or meditation, about which there are a lot of resources out there. I think you mentioned, and it's not that you're doing the same thing, it's not the same activity, but it's the way you achieve it, the somewhat indirect way, the compassionate way, I don't know how to describe it, the way that you achieve it is similar. I think you mentioned earlier a book called, what was the name of the book?
Fully Present. Catcher in the Rye.
No, Fully Present.
Fully Present.
Yeah, UCLA. Would something like that help, do you think, to like read that book and learn a little bit about mindfulness? Would that help in being aware of one's emotions and regulating them?
Fully Present is my favorite book on mindfulness. It integrates... It's written by the Mindful Awareness and Research Center folks over at UCLA, and it really integrates both the science and the practice of mindfulness. So what we're talking about, I mean, what somatic tracking is a form of mindfulness. Mindfulness just means paying attention to anything. from a place of, you know, objective curiosity. But what we're talking about is a specific kind of body-focused mindfulness, which I was actually just watching a TEDx talk yesterday, and they've actually found that focusing on the physical sensations in your body and just following them is an even more powerful form of mindfulness than some of the other types of mindfulness with regard to that kind of alpha wave control that I was talking about earlier. So yeah, it's a specific implementation of mindfulness meditation.
Excellent. Okay. Question six. Now I have been leading a little bit towards, I'm prioritizing questions that were submitted earlier that got a lot of likes and that relate specifically to the program, but we've been doing a lot of that deep stuff so far. And I thought maybe we'd throw in some questions that got a lot of likes, but are broader. But we won't emphasize too much those. We do want to keep it. This is for people who've read the whole program. So anyway, doubt seems to always set in when dealing with pain, and especially numbness of neuropathy. My pain is generally better when I'm off my feet and worse when I'm on them. Is this conditioned response to a structure? Actually, this one is totally. Anyway, is this conditioned response or a structural issue, i.e. pressure on the foot? Also, numbness never goes away. How do I reconcile that as TMS?
Well, the thing about conditioned responses is if you have pain that's structurally caused or you have pain that's TMS, it generally behaves the same way. You know, when I had really bad back pain, it hurt every time I sat and it felt better every time I laid down, and I had TMS. But if I had had a structural injury, it would have behaved exactly the same way. So it's hard to distinguish between whether or not it's something structural or whether or not it's something TMS simply by the pain behavior. Now, sometimes you'll get really lucky and you'll have an exception, right? So on day 5 of the program, you hear me do an outcome independence exercise with Christy, and she got an exception. She was able to type for 7 minutes and she didn't have any pain. So it was almost kind of like there was a chink in the armor. And, you know, we had the evidence we needed. But most of the time, you don't get those exceptions. And so the pain behavior is going to be similar, regardless of whether or not it's structural or TMS. So, you know, that's one of the areas where it's really important to really assess the evidence. When did the pain start? You know, how did it start? Do you have a history of other TMS symptoms? And the number one thing that I tell people is go see a TMS physician who can specialize in distinguishing between structural pain and TMS. Even if there isn't one in your city, hop on a plane, go out to Michigan, spend 3 hours with Howard Schubiner. It'll set you back $800 in, you know, 2 days. But what is more valuable than alleviating that uncertainty?
All right. Question 7. So I'm going to do, I think I have 2 more questions I wanted to do, and then I'm just going to kind of open it up. Chat room, people ask your questions after this. Rick says he does Skype also, I think. Okay. Question 7.
Rick.
No?
This is becoming a Rick-centric webinar.
Well, you know, I'm his voice. No. Okay. So how do you deal with pressure from family and friends who want, quote, to do things, vacation, hiking, parties, etc. When you're in pain, I find that the pressure makes the symptoms worse because it stirs up anger, guilt, and other emotions. Any thoughts on dealing with others?
Christy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I encourage you to be selfish on your journey to recovery, I would say. I would guess that most of us here are used to prioritizing others, and so your recovery is not an excuse to continue doing that. If somebody's hiking is pressuring you to go for a hike and that's not a step that you feel comfortable with, then just practice saying no and being comfortable making other people uncomfortable. Like, you need to take care of yourself.
Christy's really, really good at that.
I'm not. I love people pleasing. But yeah, that's okay. People aren't going to understand. I get that question all the time from my patients. How do I explain this? People are pushing back. They're saying they don't get it. That's okay. Not everyone in your life needs to understand what you're going through, and not everyone in your life is going to get it. I just really encourage that person who's asking to be selfish. Other people are not supposed to justify what baby steps you're ready to take.
I would like to know what interferes or complicates somatic tracking. It seems harder to do than expected. How important is it? And I'll say, from my perspective, I try to do somatic tracking and it just, you know, I do it and I'm like, okay, I feel my body, but I'm like, I kind of feel like I'm in that same boat. So what advice do you have for people like us?
But why is feeling your body not enough?
Maybe that's the answer.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're looking, you know, it's like if somebody achieves spiritual enlightenment, they're able to just kind of enjoy every breath they take. You know, like they don't need something really exciting, a vacation around the corner, in order to feel joy. You know, they don't need stimulation in order to feel, you know, in a positive state. You're actually able to just enjoy, you know. I feel like I glimpsed spiritual enlightenment one time. I was in my car on the way back from a family session. I used to do in-home family sessions, and I rolled down my window and I put my arm out of the car and I felt the wind blowing against my arm. And I there was about 30 seconds or so when I was just like, this is the greatest sensation that anyone has ever felt. Maybe it was a manic episode, come to think of it. No, not really. It was actually very peaceful. It was just, I was just so enjoying and in tune with just the physical sensation of the wind against my arm. And when you're in a good place, you don't need stimulation in order to be happy or content. You can just be happy and content with what is. So Forrest, even as you're talking about, okay, I'm paying attention to my body, now what? It almost seems like that in and of itself, you're looking for something to happen. Whereas if you could just enjoy that process, that's what somatic tracking is.
All right. Traven, I will say I'm not the most fully present person because I'm multitasking and producing. So, but that certainly makes sense. I mean, I think that my process for all of this is going to be to extract the MP3 and then listen to it on the phone when I go for my walks. But I think, I mean, I guess the insights really do come when you practice it and when you try and do it. And I guess this to some degree is a dialogue that goes on for a while. Traven does ask what I think is a good follow-up question. I can feel my skin and nerve endings, but I don't feel that I can identify what's happening on the inside of my body. And I think that's a somatic tracking question. It's all yours.
You feel your nerve endings? What is that?
It's Traven. I can be Traven's voice, but Traven, do you want to talk? I'm going to unmute you, Traven.
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, it just has more to do with, I feel like all my nerve endings are on the outside, are the skin sensations and things like that. But I feel like I'm trying too hard to identify what's happening internally and what my internal physical state is when I'm doing this.
Traven, is it Traven or Traven?
Traven.
Traven, when you attend to the physical sensations of your nerve endings, which I think you're conceptualizing as being your external state instead of your internal state, is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? Is it neutral? What is the characteristic of the attention?
It's mostly neutral.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's somatic tracking. You're aware of your physical sensations. It doesn't matter if the sensations are coming from your heart or, you know, your the inside of your stomach, you're aware of physical sensations. And I don't think that there's any advantage to it being a deeper physical sensation than a more external one. That's it. The goal is to pay attention to the physical sensations, free of fear, free of judgment, free of ulterior motive. And if those sensations are in your feet, your stomach, your heart, your throat, your head, your skin, or your nerve endings, it's equally effective.
Okay, I think I understand.
Cool.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Anyone else want to jump in? I kind of like having people unmute. Does anyone want to unmute and ask their own question? Give you some time for that.
I've been trying to type a question, so I'll ask it.
Sounds good.
Slow typist. This is, sort of goes back to what Alan was saying recently, the other night, about your own process, about somatic tracking many times in the day. Do you remember it? You said, like, you went back again and again and again. You made a decision in the morning.
Yeah.
And I find that really useful, but I forget. And I sort of forget my way in, and I forget to try. What? How did you not forget to try? How did you do that?
Do you want to tell that story, Alan? Because I don't think we've said that story here.
Yeah.
Did I miss that?
No, that's a great question. And I was actually just looking for something. Hold on, let me see if I could find it real quick. Okay. All right. So, one of my patients actually sent me this. It's amazing. When I was, you know, it was probably 2005 or 2006, but I realized that when I attended to my internal state, I felt better, I felt calmer. It was, you know, a really good feeling, but I just wasn't doing it that often. And so for maybe like a month or two, I was like, oh, you need to do it more, you need to do it more. And I just still wasn't doing it more often. I mean, it's hard to do something when you're not in the habit of it. So I remember one day I just decided, okay, the only way that I'm going to change this habit is if I do it a lot. And the only way that I'm going to do it a lot is if I just decide that this is a priority to me. So I just decided that for 3 weeks, I was going to make attending to my internal state the most important thing in my life, more important than school or work or friends or relationship or family, anything. This was going to be the thing that I was going to center my life around for 3 weeks. And so, you know, I would write notes up and I would put them up. I would set alarms on my phone. You know, I would wake up in the morning and that was my decision. And I just, throughout the day, that was the thing that I was going to do. And it got to a point where I was able to do it at several hundred times a day. And I remember, and I may be distorting this retrospectively because I know they say you could change any habit in 3 weeks. But like on day 21, I remember waking up, and even before I was fully conscious, I was very aware of the physical sensation of my breath in my body, and I was breathing really slowly. And it's like I was somatic tracking unconsciously. That's how much of a habit it had become. And so probably after only 3 weeks of deciding to make it a priority more than anything else, I was doing it about 50% of the day. The more you practice, the more it can become a default setting. So one of my patients actually sent me an app that is a chime that your phone makes every half hour. And so it serves as a reminder to get you in the habit. The more you practice, the more you'll ingrain those neural pathways, the easier it will be to remember. So it's that first step of remembering to remember that is the hardest hurdle to overcome. So if you download an app, go to the App Store and you download the app called Chime. It looks like a green box with a little alarm bell in the corner. After downloading, set to a half hour, choose your time gap, and select your sound. So then right there, you already have 20 or 30 reminders every day. The more reminders you get, the more you're going to practice. The more you practice, the easier it's going to be for your brain to remember. Great question, though.
Thanks.
Anyone else want to jump in?
Hey, hi, it's Lauren.
Hey, Lauren.
Hi, I stopped walking. I'm sitting on a bench. You guys have done so much for me. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yep, but you're still upside down. Okay. But keep going. Yep.
Okay, how's that?
All right, good. Yeah, we're happy now.
My garden. Okay, my question really is, I've done a lot of work, and TMS, my back went out 2 years ago, and I discovered John Sarno, and I discovered a whole world within me, and it's been amazing. I don't have much sciatic pain anymore, but here's my question, and I've seen it in threads, is that I'm doing very well. I can see my pain stops and goes, so, oh, gee, that's my answer. But then I have anxiety out of the blue, and it's been really hard for me to track that because it seems to blur my mind when I get it. I can't think. For example, I'm a flight attendant, so I want to tell everybody, stop being afraid of flying, for heaven's sake. Safer than driving. But anyway, I get off a flight, and I'm heading home, and now I'm broken up with a boyfriend of 2.5 years, and I can't even think straight. And any advice on some tracking when anxiety comes? It takes over, and I see it just seems to be another device of my brain to keep me on fear, because that's what the habit of my life has probably been. Being
the cloudiness
afraid,
you're talking about and the fuzziness, Lauren.
Yeah, the fuzziness of the brain.
That's a manifestation of anxiety. So, you know, the way that I kind of look at it or think about it is like anxiety, generating anxiety is like water filling up in a bucket. And if you're somatic tracking, if you're attending to the physical sensations in your body, it's almost like dumping that bucket out every time the water reaches the level. And so that's one of the things that you want to practice. But if you don't check in for long enough, the water will rise and rise and rise to the point where it will start overflowing. And I think that when you're already in that place of fuzziness, that's the bucket overflowing. So I would say at that point, just wait for it to pass. But the goal isn't necessarily to get rid of the fuzziness when it comes up. It's to get in the habit of attending internally regularly to the point where you don't get to that place where your bucket is overflowing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I muted Laura. I'm going to unmute her now. You're back.
That's very helpful to me. You know, sometimes you have to remember that it's not about the anxiety. It's about the constant self awareness, like attending to the self. I love that. And I love those three things that you said about the kind of rubbing your heart, cognitively saying it. And that's huge. What a huge practice. That's going to be my half hour. Thank you. Right. That's all Thanks, I have to Lauren. Say. Thank you.
Thanks, Lauren.
Jean had a question. Jean writes, in the past, I've used exercise, the endorphins, as a way to feel good about myself. And more was always better. Now I have pain in part because I feel guilty that I have not been able to figure out a way to accept myself, practice self-love, even when I am doing a safe amount of exercise. How can I address this guilt, self-acceptance, exercise complex?
Christy? I don't see the question. Can you repeat it, Rob? Where is it?
I will repaste it into the chat room. It scrolled away. It's on its way. There it is.
I just got a text from Christy that says, I don't understand this question. Don't call on me. Oops. Yay. You guys just saw behind the curtain. In the past, I've used exercise as a way to feel good about myself, and more was always better. So far, so good. Now I have pain, in part because I feel guilty that I have not been able to figure out a way to accept myself / practice self-love even when I am doing a safe amount of exercise. How can I address the guilt self-acceptance exercise complex? Help. Now I have pain, in part because I feel guilty that I have not been able to figure out a way to accept myself / practice self-love even when I am doing a safe amount of exercise. Okay, so it seems to me like you are judging yourself negatively for not being able to practice self-love while you're doing a safe amount of exercise. Okay, deconstructing Gene. All right, so this is what's actually going on. Now you're not judging yourself because of the pain. You're judging yourself because of your inability to tame the pain. So in this instance, there's no difference between the pain and your ability to tame the pain. You're just replacing one thing to beat yourself up about with another thing. You're replacing one thing to be scared about with another thing. TMS is not pain. TMS is anything that serves as a vessel for fear or preoccupation. So it doesn't matter if that thing that serves as a vessel for fear and preoccupation is pain, is repetitive thoughts, is flying, is anything. The goal is not to fundamentally change your relationship with pain. The goal is to fundamentally change your relationship with fear and judgment. So I would even say if you could find a way to accept the fact that you can't practice self-love, that in and of itself is self-love. What do you think about that, Christy?
That was a tough question. We've never been asked that before, but it was, Gene, I hope we didn't make you feel like it wasn't a good question. It was just a tough one.
Look at you, honing your inner Christy. Very strength-based perspective.
Cool. Okay. I did want to mention a bunch of the people of the community have found Kristen Neff's work, and it, especially given the mindfulness connection here, maybe natural. I think self-compassion is something that I've struggled with also a lot, and I think it's a process that it's an unfolding. And something that you kind of learn to get better at, over time. And it sounds like Alan's given you a good place to start on that. Like you have to stop at the highest, it's like us, we self, critical individuals, we have self-criticism on top of self-criticism on top of self-criticism. And to some level, you have to start at that top level and say, wait a second, why am I being so hard on myself for being self-critical about myself? You know what? At least let me be self-critical of myself in peace. And then you can kind of maybe unwind it.
Be self-critical of myself in peace. That's what Buddha actually refers to as the second arrow. You know, he says that it's like there's already the pain or the anxiety, and that's already one type of suffering, but it's that second arrow where it's like you beat yourself up or you put pressure on yourself because of that first arrow, because of the pain and anxiety. So that first arrow you can't do anything about directly, but the second arrow you can. Yeah, I do like your question, Gene.
Yeah, that's like the paradox of overcoming psychogenic pain that I started with. It's that second arrow. It's okay, the pressure that we put on ourselves. Gene, feel free to follow up if you have a question.
Are you not hearing me or seeing my chat messages anymore?
Is this Gene?
Yes.
I am seeing. I just saw. Or do I have to accept myself without the activities?
I guess I feel guilty about it. I'm having trouble accepting myself, so I think immediately it instills this pain, and that because I don't feel like I'm doing it for the right reasons. So I feel like I'm doing it for the wrong reason. And I think that instills a lot of pain and it just keeps the cycle going. Does that make sense?
I'm just obsessed with your snowboard. I didn't even hear what you said. That's the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, you can see. I thought I blocked myself.
So you're saying that you feel guilty about trying to run because you use running to make yourself feel okay about yourself. Then you have pain.
Yes, I think so. I mean, that's what I think. I'm trying to identify the emotions that are behind this because I've been able to do some other stuff. Like I've been able to get into the pool and swim, but for whatever reason, this running has always been like, it's constantly been a cycle where I get into the pain and it just keeps getting worse and I try to push through it and then I just have to stop. And I feel like it's because it has held such a great weight on me. I've given it so much importance to take the place of how I feel and instead.
So you feel guilty about trying to run and you are, not really sure what to do because you feel like that guilt is causing you pain?
Maybe. I mean, that's what I was kind of thinking. I mean, unless you can unwrap it a different way. I'm not really sure because I get mad at myself because I have the pain because I feel like there's no reason for the pain because I feel bad about myself and that's why I'm having the pain.
I get the sense that you're really bright and really thoughtful, that your mind is, you know, analytical in a way. Is that accurate?
I'm definitely one of those highly sensitive people, I think.
Okay.
So,
where did you go?
What?
Oh, I shut off our video.
Oh, okay. I think that a lot of times, you know, Albert Einstein said, it's a great quote, and I'm not quoting it accurately, but something along the lines of like, if you try to solve a problem with the same part of the brain that caused the problem in the first place, I'm not even going to try. Let me just answer your question. I think that, you know, you're trying to figure this thing out cognitively. It kind of reminds me of when someone is trying to figure out what emotion they feel, like going through their left brain. Like, okay, well, I grew up in this environment and my boss just said this. And, you know, because I grew up with parents that never really made me feel heard, the fact that my boss didn't respond back to me after 3 hours of sending him an email, I must be feeling angry. And so a lot of times people actually try to figure out their emotions by kind of logically working it out. Whereas the way to feel emotions is to just lean into your body. So I think that Gene, what I'm hearing from you is this part of your brain that is really analytical and intent on and good at figuring things out, trying to get to the bottom of these things. But I don't think that's necessarily the best channel. Usually the reasons why don't even matter as much as we think. You know, we feel emotions just by attending to the physical sensation in our body. You could process an emotion without even knowing what the emotion is. Is this sadness? Is this surprise? Is this anger? And so I think that getting to the root of why you have pain is less important than honing the skill of paying attention to your body.
Okay.
Because I think that I could, even if I were to like thoroughly answer your question in a very logical and evidence-based way, I'm not sure that that would do as much as you just hearing the activity of your mind and saying, oh, this is that part of my brain that's trying to figure things out. What are you feeling right now? And then just bringing your attention to your body. And then 10 minutes later, well, I'm in pain. Is it because I'm guilty, because I'm doing this thing, because I'm not generating enough self-compassion? Oh, wait a minute. That's just the part of your brain that is really intent on trying to figure things out. What do you feel in your body right now? Right? Going through the body is the path to teaching our primitive brain that it's safe. going through the mind oftentimes is just that busy work.
Yeah. I guess I just don't get, because it's hard to make a decision, there's kind of two sides to it, is that, you know, if I keep pushing through the pain, I feel like I need to do that to break the cycle, because I see it going on over and over and over. Obviously, I've analyzed it, and I see the cycle going over and over and over, but I also see the need to be gentle with oneself, and I think that could apply to everybody, where we've talked about not just pushing for through things. So that is where I guess I'm kind of stuck.
I'm hearing the same thing again.
Okay.
It's like you're doing the same thing that I was just talking about. Do you see how your mind goes to some sort of dichotomy where it's like, I'm doing this thing that's generating pain, but also I need to feel compassion, and I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to lean into the pain or da 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 da. I think that kind of energy, that kind of back and forth, that kind of getting pulled in multiple directions over not knowing what to do is the fuel for the pain.
Yeah.
And I think that sometimes even giving ourselves the message, you know what, it's going to be okay either way. There are different paths to recovery. I'm just going to enjoy my life, do what I feel like doing in the moment, and attend to my internal state is way more valuable than even which path you end up choosing. Giving yourself the message, it's going to be okay either way. You're okay. And just doing what you decide to do in the moment and attending to your internal state. Because oftentimes it's that limbo state of should I do this or should I do that, that's really responsible for activating our danger signals. Mm-hmm. So it isn't the question that you're asking, it's the fact that you're asking that question. It's going to be okay either way.
Thank you. I think I've taken up enough time. Appreciate it.
Thanks for your question. ITMSW has a question, which I think probably is on a bunch of people's minds. She says, how do we resolve regret or sorrow or anger for having this chronic pain that has been so severe that it has created so many losses, loss of job, partner, friends, home, etc.?
Christy, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I'll take it, but I feel like anyone could really jump in here.
Did you move?
Yeah, I had to move. I had a technical emergency.
Did you move into your wedding room?
I moved into my wedding room, yes. But yeah, I feel like, yes, me, Forrest, and Alan are running this webinar right now, but this is something that I think every single person in this group has experienced. And I'm hoping, Irene, that just being in this group and realizing that you're not the only person who has lost a lot by having this pain, and it's not your fault. It's not any of our faults. We didn't ask for this. We didn't wake up one day and say, hey, I want to have debilitating pain for the next X number of years. And there's lots of factors that go into it. So I guess my advice to you is just be easy on yourself. Like, being hard on yourself is what got you into this pain. So being hard on yourself is not the way to get out of it. And we've all experienced that. It's not just you. Every single person in this chat room has had pain and has had to deal with the consequences of having that pain. And it wasn't your fault. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't any of our faults. So that's okay. It's okay.
Thank you.
Excellent. Okay. Next question. Oh, just to let people know, I mentioned this earlier before the recording, but the chat room is being recorded, so don't send me private messages that are truly private. Because I'm doing a screen grab on that.
I think I'm 6 months pregnant, and I think it's yours.
Exactly. If anyone has said something in the chat message which is particularly private, contact me, and then I just won't post it. That's fine. The next question is, Well, Judy said something powerful. When someone said to me, it's not your fault, I just broke down and cried because I felt like the pain was my fault. Something that many have struggled with. Okay, so you're not alone. Next question. There are some really good questions that were emailed to me earlier, so I do want to get to these. Very focused on the program. I have been using systematic desensitization from day 16. I have many areas with long-term chronic pain. I have been using this procedure on each location every day, or would it be just as effective to choose just one spot each day?
What a deep question. I don't know. I don't think that there's enough, you know, there haven't been any evidence-based studies on that. My hunch is that it really would be okay either way. You know, like it's both going to be effective. Like either way, you're trying to teach yourself this is safe. You know, you can honestly, and this might not be a satisfying answer, but you could honestly try just doing it on one location every day for a week. And then the next week you can try it on different locations and see what feels better for you. You know, one of the things that about the 21-day recovery program that was important to me was I didn't want to specifically tell people, this is what you do, this is what you do every day, this is when you do it, because I think that honing a stance of empowerment is an important component to recovery, and actually deciding this is what I'm going to do because it works for me is empowering. So having people have the different tools and deciding what works for them and when it works for them is really part of the recovery process. So figure it out, experiment, do trial and error, make a decision, and then feel proud of yourself about making that decision.
That sounds good. I have a page that I made on the wiki at one point. I think it was called Be a Scientist, in the sense that we all have to figure it out for ourselves. And I think because no one could figure it out better than you can, because you're the only one who knows your own internal experience. So I think that's one of the transformative things that happens for a lot of us as we go through the TMS journey, is figuring out exactly what approach to treatment works for us and exactly what we need. And perhaps most importantly, how to listen to ourselves and be that compassionate way to ourselves. This looks like Scott wants us to circle back on his question about regret and disappointment. Can you paste that question in, Scott? While you're doing that, I'm going to do the next question I have lined up. This was submitted earlier. It's question 4. The program has helped me. We're going to be releasing this as a podcast, so I'm trying to read them. The program has helped me, or just the audio, that's all. Not on iTunes or anything. The program has helped me bring a lot of pieces together. Probably the most important is a clear taste of seeing various pain and discomfort as a guide rather than a problem. Here's my question. I have been particularly interested in day 20 about joy. I see I pressure myself and set up myself with expectations and preconceived ideas. This is frequently my undoing because it is so clever. It is usually in the name of a good inner cause that I sacrifice my greater good and joy. I have experience of seeing through the layers of good intentions that keep me trapped in this reaction, but I still spend a lot of time having to sort it out till something wakes up and goes, aha, you could come back to yourself now. Do you have any advice to recognize in the moment and stand up to a train of thought that is so well meaning and so very wrong at the same time?
Christy?
I think the thing that sticks out to me most in that question is he writes, there's usually a good reason, a good cause to sacrifice my greater good and joy. And I guess that sticks out to me because I don't understand what would be a good reason to sacrifice your own inner joy. So I realize I'm not answering. I have a question about that.
Is the person who asked that question here?
Scott's on the text of the chat right now.
No, that's Scott's a different question.
Oh, that's a different Scott.
Yeah.
It's me that asked that. It's Susan.
Oh, hi.
And hi. Susan. And it's because, I don't remember why I wrote it that way either in this moment.
Well, do you just want to clarify that? Or is it answered already?
Well, I think that it's that, I think it's that I get so lost in the trying to come back somatically at the same time as it's like I'm struggling back and forth between trying to come into myself and being attracted to all of the mental junk. I think it's been answered already. I think it's the time.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah. Keep coming back.
All right. Okay. Well, we're going to have to wrap up soon. Ellen has been very gracious to let us go quite a bit late, but let's see if we can wrap up by 5 o'clock. Does anyone have any questions that are feeling really, really urgent to them at the moment?
Yeah, this is Scott. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Yeah, the question I texted in, you know, one thing I have a hard time getting past is the regret of the precipitating event. I have a lower back injury, and when I try to lift something really heavy and I think about, oh, if only coulda, shoulda, woulda, I didn't do that, I wouldn't have been in this situation. You know, kind of getting past that.
That is the, it's like the bargaining stage of grief. It's really interesting. It's really kind of like a sneaky way of feeling less out of control. So oftentimes if we feel internally out of control, we'll have the desire to kind of control our external environment to compensate for that feeling. And oftentimes when we go to, you know, like, oh, if I wouldn't have done that, this wouldn't have happened. Oh, I should have done that. It's like, it's really giving ourselves that illusion of control. Like, things could be different if I would have done something differently. So I think, again, even just kind of shining a light on the reason why your mind goes to that and just recognizing that as an indication that your primitive brain isn't feeling safe, and let it feel safe. So you lift something up, you know, your back is in pain and you're feeling like, you know, very out of control. You're feeling unsafe. You're in pain. You don't know if you did something structural or if it's TMS. So your mind automatically goes to, if only I had done something differently. Okay, what is that? That's my mind actually trying to do something to feel less out of control by giving, you know, myself the illusion that I could have done something to prevent it or da 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 da. I mean, it's over. It's in the past. This is just a sign that my primitive brain is feeling unsafe right now, is feeling out of control. You're safe. It's okay. You could calm down. Again, we don't have to engage with the activity of our mind. Just because our mind says something, that doesn't mean we need to say something back. Oftentimes, if you can look at the activity of your mind as an indication that you're feeling unsafe, as opposed to something to engage with, to battle with, to figure out, then you're really kind of seeing behind the matrix, so to speak.
Right. So, I mean, is there a that is helpful, but do you have a tool like of really making your mind say, hey, look, that's water under the bridge. There's nothing you can do about it. Kind of a thing.
I mean, honestly, I think that saying that's water under the bridge, there's nothing you can do about it, is engaging with it. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's saying, oh, you should have done that. And you're like, no, it's not my fault. Yeah, you know, you could have done something differently. No, you know, it's behind you. To me, that's just kind of engaging with the activity of your mind. If you're really able to see that your mind even goes there in the first place, just as a way to make you feel less out of control, you don't even need to engage with the content. You're kind of pulling the curtain back on why your mind even goes there in the first place, looking at the fact that it did go there as an indication that you're feeling unsafe, and use that as an opportunity to make yourself feel safe. Then you kind of like skirt that whole potential back and forth that could come up as a consequence of it.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. That's good, thanks.
Good.
Can I get one last question in? It's a quick safety one.
Sure.
Okay. Good thing, you know, important thing to end on. Not necessarily for treatment, but as a precondition for treatment for everyone. not treatment, but anyway, I do wonder how to practice de-identifying from these pain signals without denying, and acknowledging without over-identifying. TMS theory is profound, but over a 20-year path, I have ignored some valid symptoms. So this person said, I had stage 4 endometriosis surgery and didn't realize the pain level until after the large lesion was gone. So how do we figure out that? I think there's a straightforward answer, but it's worth repeating.
Christy?
Yeah, go to a doctor, specifically go to a TMS-trained doctor. Yes, we are all prone to pain symptoms moving around and getting new ones and getting challenged in new ways, but not every pain symptom is TMS. It doesn't mean that you're not following the model if you go get doctor's clarification that you're okay. So absolutely, just go get it checked out.
Yeah, I agree. I think that sometimes people feel guilty about wanting to get more information, but I had 22 different TMS symptoms, but then I tore a ligament in my wrist. And I was so used to just thinking everything was psychogenic that I woke up the next morning and I started challenging it. And I was like, you're not real, you're not gonna scare me. And I literally started bending my wrist back and my whole palm swelled up. And I ended up needing to get surgery as a result of that, because I was treating it as TMS when it isn't. So, if you have new symptoms popping up every week and they don't make it, there's no rhyme or reason to it. Obviously, you're not going to go to a doctor every time. But yeah, if there's something that you're unsure about, go to a TMS doctor, because you want to get clarity and be comprehensive before you decide what course of treatment you're going to take.
All right, folks, I know that there are more questions, but I can only ask our guests to stay so long. Perhaps if we're lucky, we'll be able to do it again sometime in the future. Sure. But I think this was, sorry?
Sure.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that. Okay, so anyway, this was tremendously, tremendously helpful. I think we should wrap up. I'm going to listen to this again. I know that. I hope you will too. And then of course it always goes down to the application. That's where we get our amazing questions from. So thank you so much to Alan and Christy for making this amazing program. I know we all very much appreciate it.
Hey, I want to emphasize something just because I ended on that. I know that even the idea of talking about the fact that, some pain is structural. And I gave an example of bending my wrist back and tearing a ligament and needing surgery. I know that sometimes even hearing that stuff can be scary, but what I want to challenge you guys to do is, if you hear a voice in your mind saying, oh God, he did that thing and he caused more damage and he needed surgery, maybe my pain isn't TMS and I have something structural too. I want you to see if you could actually take that as an opportunity to say, there's my mind trying to scare me again. That's when you're really onto this thing. When you see that your mind is going to look for opportunities all over the place is a way to scare you and to say, there you go again. I know what you're trying to do and I know why you're trying to do it, and then make yourself feel safe. All right.
Yeah. That's what I like about this program, is it's very empowering. Like it puts us in charge.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, folks, thanks for showing up. And drop by, post in the threads, and we'll be in touch. Bye.
Thank you so much, Forrest, Christy, and Alan. Thank you.
Bye, guys.
Very welcome.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
So much appreciated.
Bye.
Thank you.